Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to continue in the third hour of our discussion of Marx's economics. Two previous shows, we began this, and if you want to pick up and get that, if you haven't heard it, go back. They're posted podcasts. Take a listen. Okay, today we're going to conclude the third show on Marx's economics and how what he said is not what contemporary economists say he said. And by contemporary, I mean not just critics of Marx, mainstream critics of Marx, but I mean also those who consider themselves Marxist economists today. Okay, so from both the left and the right, say Marx said certain things, but it's a misrepresentation of what he actually said. We're going to deal with two arguments, two issues, two topics here. One is the falling rate of profit tendency that contemporary Marxist economists, many of them, not all, but many of them, say is the heart of Marx's explanation of why there are capitalist crises. Okay, falling rate of profit. Within capitalism, there is a tendency for the rate of profit to fall over time, and that tendency precipitates crises. Now, contemporary Marxists slip into the false assumption that what Marx meant by crises was these short-term crises like depressions or even great recessions. You know, what happened in 2008, what happened in the 1930s, maybe what's going on now, that these are the crises that can be explained by the falling rate of profit tendency. This is not true, but many of them use profits as the falling rate of profits. I'm saying rate, not level of profits now, rate of change from one period to the next. When that rate falls, then that precipitates a crisis. In other words, the single variable explains the crisis. Really simplistic. Okay, so the falling rate of profit tendency, we'll deal with that. The second argument that we'll address here, explaining how Marx's economics are not what people say it is, comes from the right. Mainstream economists, many of them hold this view to the extent that they even read Marx anymore. And this view is that Marx failed to show how values get actually transformed into prices, market prices. You know, because volume one is about value, right? Labor theory of value. Workers create all value. Capitalists extract that value and capture that value for themselves. And in previous shows, we discussed how the two main methods by which exploitation, i.e., the transforming of values created by labor into surplus value captured by capitalists, two main ways that occurs. One is what Marx called absolute surplus value, and the other is relative surplus value. And in previous show, we explained absolute surplus value is how the workday is extended, but the amount paid to the workers is not increased proportionally, right? And we explain how there were new concepts Marx created in this process of explaining this extension of the workday, socially necessary labor that was actually paid only a part of the value all day that the worker created. In other words, socially necessary labor was the amount of wage that was given, allowed for the worker to keep while the worker created a surplus over socially necessary labor. And that was the surplus value that the capitalists kept. Okay, and you know, mid-19th century is pretty obvious. Read Dickens and others how the workday, in an absolute sense, was expanded. But last week we talked about how, particularly in the last 40 years, the workday is also being expanded in a lot of different ways. I'm not going to go over the list of those, but it's easy to show that the workday is getting longer for workers. Once again, you know, for a long period of time, early first half or so of the first two-thirds of the 20th century, the workday was reduced. And therefore, the surplus value extracted by extending the workday in the 20th century was actually reduced. Well, the capitalists offset that by increasing relative surplus values very significantly. Relative surplus value, as we explain, is really how, given a particular workday, let's hold it constant, that capitalists use machinery and capital and technology and so forth to have workers produce more, in other words, intensify the exploitation within a given workday. Workers still don't get any more, or even if they do get more, the capitalists extract far more than what the increase is given to the worker. So exploitation rises relatively within the workday. And we gave examples of that. Well, that's, you know, almost obvious. We know that. Capitalist equipment, machinery, capital of various forms, technology, software, hardware, whatever, intensifies how much a worker can produce, i.e. raises productivity. We know in the last 40 years, productivity has increased tremendously, but wages haven't. Okay, so even just talking in market terms, we can see that relative surplus value exploitation has really accelerated. Now, at the same time, as we said, absolute extending the workday has also extended, you know, subtly, or not so subtly sometimes, not in the absolute sense, but, you know, just as one example to repeat how we've got 50, 60 million people working part-time. Well, they're working two or three part-time jobs. Well, when you put them all together, the workday has really increased. That's only one example we talked about last week. And we know productivity is a, you know, an example, a proxy for the intensification of relative exploitation. Okay, so in Marx, both absolute and relative surplus value, you know, and these are the greatest concepts, I think, in Marx, because, you know, workers know that's the case. You don't have to get into some esoteric value theory explanation to convince workers that they're working harder and working longer, and that their pay is not increasing. They know that, right? So, you know, this is where Marx's theory really stands on its feet in explaining what goes on. You know, and as Marxism is about how exploitation in capitalism of labor is really the driver of the whole process of capitalist transformation and evolution. It's an exploitation theory of capital. Okay. And you got to understand, as we said before, that Marx is talking about the long run. This is a supply side long run view, just like all of classical economics. Supply side from Smith on, supply side long run explanations. And whenever the capitalist classicalist attempted to take the concepts and the analysis of the long run growth of capitalism and explain short run phenomenon like depressions, they did a terrible job. they could not do it using the conceptual framework, which is of classical economics, which is really designed to explain how capitalism expands over the long run. And as we said, Marx adopted that framework in large part, but he innovated on it. He added certain new concepts, like he broke through the labor theory of value by assuming social averages and using the proxy of labor of time to express exploitation, so that now he could quantify exploitation and the labor theory of value using the proxy of time and staying with social averages and staying with long-run analysis. So Marx's explanation of the crisis of capitalism is really a long-run supply-side breakdown of capitalism. It's a breakdown. It's not an explanation of short-run depressions and business cycle crises. Okay, so now we get to the point of the falling rate of profit tendency, a concept and an argument used by contemporary Marxists. It's the lodestone, you know. It's the be-all and end-all explanation of why we get short-term crises, like depressions. The rate of profit falls, precipitating crises. That's contemporary Marxist analysis using the falling rate of profit idea. Now, as I've said before, Marx does not talk about the falling rate of profit in his published work of Volume 1. And you got to keep in mind, therefore, you know, if it's not published, you know, if he's talking about maybe a falling rate of profit tendency, but he's doing it in his notes that never get published, did he really embrace it totally? Did he really feel confident if he didn't publish it? Now he starts talking about, in vague terms, the falling rate of profit tendency in notes even before he wrote Volume 1 of Capital in 1865-67. Okay? His notes in preparation of that in late 1850s, you know, he tinkers with this falling rate of profit idea. But he doesn't put it in Volume 1. And then after the publication of Volume 1, he's writing about it again in Volume 3. You know, exploring. These are explorations about, well, maybe there's something here, but he never publishes it. He's never really confident about it, in my view. Nonetheless, contemporary Marxists adopt it as the truth, the final statement, and not only a final statement, but the key to explaining why we have short-run business cycle crises. That's incorrect. Incorrect. Not only because it wasn't published, right? But you can't use a concept that's designed to maybe say something about the long-run breakdown of capitalism to explain short-run disequilibria, i.e. depressions, great recessions, recessions even, okay? You can't do that. But they do it nonetheless. Let's explain this a little deeper, right? What is the falling rate of profit tendency in Marx that contemporary Marxist economists embrace as the be-all and end-all? What is it? Okay, let's go back and look at some of Marx's concepts here. Right? Now, Volume 1 of Capital, remember, as I said in previous shows, is at a very high level of abstraction and generality. This is Hegelian methodology of going from the general to the particular, the abstract to the concrete, and Volume 1, where he talks about value theory and explains exploitation in terms of value, was envisioned by Marx as the first of 8 volumes. He never got to the other volumes. He's too busy with real politics in the real world. Okay? So, you know, we have this issue where we're at a very high level generality and we're talking about value. Now, Marx knew he eventually would have to explain exploitation in price terms. In the real world, you know, it's prices that we're dealing with, not abstract concepts like value. However, since it's the labor theory of value that's the core of exploitation, you got to start out by explaining the process in terms of the concept of value. You know, labor is the source of all value. In other words, it's labor that creates all products. And, you know, in the 18th century, you could, under Smith and so forth, you could see this more clearly. Things were done, created mostly by hand. Yeah, there was some machinery to help, but it was pretty clear that workers made the machinery too. And the capitalists start out from being workers, and they end up hiring other workers, and the gap between capitalist and worker expands. Okay, so it was easy to see that labor was the source of all value back then, and it was still easy relatively to see in mid-19th century when Marx is writing. So the labor theory of value is the way to express exploitation and how capitalism evolves, which is what Marx tried to do. Now, Marx knew that prices had to be explained. He starts out with value, but he makes a big assumption in Volume 1, and that is products exchange at their values, and it's assumed that value and price are equal. We're going to hold the two, that when products sell in the marketplace at a price, that price is equal to the value created in those products. So value and price are synonymous. They're the same. We're assuming that. And the assumption is in the long run, they are the same. Of course, in the short run, they will not be the same. But Marx, you know, this value-price relationship here is not like the unlike the classical economists who assume that labor and value was at the core of a price of a product in the marketplace, and then market price fluctuations were around the core value equals price of a product. In other words, you had two price theory here. You had value got transformed into price in the marketplace, but that market price could fluctuate around that core value price based on forces of supply and demand. That's classical economics. Well, Marx, being a classical economist, really assumes the same. That value is price in the long run, but in the short run, probably price would fluctuate around value. But we're still talking only about the long run here. In Volume 1. Now, Marx makes some other typical classical economics assumptions in his whole analysis in Volume 1 as well. And that is labor and capital are heterogeneic, right? And that labor and capital are not mobile. There is no labor and capital mobility, because if there were, you would have big differences between Company A and Company B in terms of profit and exploitation, industry, business equipment industry versus consumer industries, right? He's assuming that we have the same ratio of capital and labor across all industries and all occupations, and that capital and labor are not mobile. They don't move between, right? And that the ratios of capital to labor in a producing a given commodity is the same in any, all the other commodities. And it's true across all industries. Now, these are the assumptions of perfect competition in classical economics. These are the assumptions of long-run analysis. And Marx adopts the same of other classical economists in Volume 1. He was going to depart from that in subsequent volumes, but he never got to it, right? So in the short run, market price is equal to value. Now, keep in mind that profit is a market concept. And wages are a market concept. Embedded in profit and wages is a core of value. But we're assuming value equals price, right? So they're one and the same. So there's profits from exploitation in production of value, extracting surplus value. There's a core profit from that. But when the commodity is sold in the marketplace, price may be different in the short run. So you get a profit from just price manipulation. A core profit and a profit from price in the marketplace. Same thing for labor. A core amount of value given to labor that's socially necessary labor. But then the wage paid to the worker might be more than socially necessary labor value, right? In other words, the wage in the marketplace may fluctuate around the core socially necessary value given to the worker in production, right? But Marx is about production first, right? This is, that makes it a supply side approach, producing goods. So, you know, profits have a dual nature to them. Profits are partly value, surplus value determined, and profits are partly price and market price determined. Keep that in mind. Profits are a market concept, not just the value concept. Wages are a market concept. Wage is just the price paid to labor, not just a value concept. But in Volume 1, he's really working on explaining the value side of the core, in other words, not the market fluctuations around value. Okay, so this is important to keep in mind when we talk about the falling rate of profit tendency here and the transformation problem later. Okay, so let's explain how we get a falling rate of profit tendency from Marx that he never published, right, based upon value analysis only, not market, not price, value. Okay? To do this, you got to understand two concepts here. One is the rate of surplus value that we've been talking about. Absolute and relative, right? Gives you a rate of surplus value extraction by capitalists in the process of production, right? Labor is the source of all value. The capitalist pays the worker only socially necessary, the average, which is an average, you know, and he keeps the rest. He keeps the rest for himself. That's the surplus value. The capitalist keeps the surplus value. Surplus goes to him after he pays socially necessary to the worker. Okay, so surplus value is really synonymous with profits in the marketplace, right? It's the surplus value. When the capitalist sells the commodity, he gets money for it, right? That's the surplus value. That's the profit he gets to keep. Okay, so the rate of surplus value is the ratio of the total value created by the worker and how much of that the capitalist keeps. Okay, it's a ratio. And surplus value is increased both absolutely and relatively. Now there's another concept here, and that's called the organic composition of capital, which is really composed of two variables. One, constant capital, which is machinery, equipment, what we think of as means of production, right? And variable capital, which is really labor, workers. Okay. And he expresses that in a ratio, again, of constant capital, or let's use the symbol C, and variable capital, the symbol V. The organic composition of capital is where the composition of C, constant capital grows greater than the increase in variable capital or workers, okay? Expressed sometimes as C over C plus V, constant capital C over constant capital plus variable capital. C is the numerator, C plus V is the denominator. So you got two C's, two ways of expressing constant capital, numerator and denominator, and only one of expressing variable capital, the worker, in the denominator. So obviously, if you're going to increase relative surplus value by increasing the amount of machinery in production that intensifies the relative exploitation of labor, workers produce more with machinery, tools. Obviously, if you're going to increase relative surplus value, well then, what happens to V in the ratio of the organic composition of capital? It goes down, right? As C, which is the numerator and denominator, goes up faster than V, workers, you get the organic composition of capital rising over time rapidly because of relative surplus value ways of exploiting labor. Now, here's the rub. If that's happening, if the organic composition, the ratio of constant capital machinery to labor increases over time, and labor is the source of all value, then value tends to decline over time. Only labor can create new value. Machinery just contributes what is using it in a depreciating kind of a way in production. The machines wear out. It doesn't create anything, right? Okay, but labor creates value. But if labor is declining in the ratio of this thing called organic composition to capital, then value is declining. Well, if value is declining, then you know what? Surplus value must be declining over time. So you got this contradiction going on. The organic composition of capital rises and the total value declines, but the value is the source of the surplus. What this means is that capitalists must find other ways of intensifying exploitation if the amount of labor in production is declining. They must exploit it even more intensely. Well, they exploit it even more intensely by adding more machinery. Well, that raises the organic composition of capital and lowers the amount of value. Think of the organic composition of capital concept as a kind of proxy for the idea of productivity. Right? We know productivity increases capitalist profits over time. It's an expression of increasing intensity of production. Productivity increases profits in the short run. But what Marx is saying with the organic composition of capital is that it, in the longer run, becomes a source of compressing profitability. Well, here we are back to Adam Smith and David Ricardo and their concepts of steady state, Smith, and stationary state, Ricardo, who said that productivity is the key to expanding capital accumulation. Both of them argued that. And that productivity at first is a big contributor to accumulating the expanding capital, but somehow over time it becomes a drag and a opposition to the further expansion. And Smith argued that led to a kind of a stagnation called a steady state. But as we said before, he never really explained it. He just made that general observation. And the same thing with Ricardo. Ricardo tried to give an explanation about how productivity rose in agriculture and then it declined in agriculture or slowed down. And that was the source of crises that got transferred over to the non-agricultural side of the economy. But didn't provide a real explanation of it. Well, these are sort of equilibrium. In other words, equilibrium ends up stagnant. We don't have growth. Equilibrium. Everything settles down into an equilibrium, no growth. Well, think of the organic composition of the capital as kind of an inheritor of that steady state, stationary state, because what Marx is saying is that, right, relative surplus value, machinery, constant capital, you know, increases relative exploitation and therefore increases surplus value on profits, but that over time, somehow, it has the opposite or countervailing effect. Why? Because the amount of labor, which is the source of all value, gets reduced relative to machinery in production. Productivity increases at first, but then productivity, you know, somehow slows down, or productivity depresses the quantity of value in labor in production, and therefore we got a slowdown, which occurs, right? Okay, so what this means is that if the organic composition of capital over time depresses the amount of labor and therefore true value in production, the capitalist must find another way to exploit or raise surplus value in other ways. Exploitation. They must offset the tendency of productivity to decline and the tendency of profits to decline because of the rising organic composition of capital, constant capital to variable capital, machinery to labor. So Marx talks about what he says these countervailing forces to kind of thwart the negative effects on value creation by a rising organic composition of capital. So what does he say? All right, he says, well, capitalists can turn around and reduce the cost of constant capital, or reduce the cost of machinery and so forth in production. And we see that today, to give some contemporary examples. I mean, what is business taxation all about? Right? Investment tax credits, faster depreciation write-offs, well, and direct subsidies, you know, all of that is really to the state, the government, assisting capitalists to reduce the cost of capital. That's what it is. Constant capital we're talking about here, right? And of course, we know that capitalists, and with the help of the state, reduce the cost of variable capital. But, you know, reducing the cost of constant capital is a bigger contribution to, you know, total profitability here, or exploitation, offsetting the tendency of exploitation surplus value to decline because of organic composition of capital rising. A capitalist could intensify exploitation. Right? They can figure out how to get even more surplus value in production, or keep socially necessary labor, the amount they pay workers in value terms, constant, or even try to depress it. Well, what's a good example of depressing it? Well, here's one of many. Shift the cost of benefits onto workers. You know, the capitalists were paying part of it. That was part of socially necessary labor. We used to get good pensions. But then they substitute 401k plans for pensions, you know, for defined benefit pensions, for example. And, of course, that's shifting the costs onto workers, which reduces socially necessary labor. The cost of SNL reduces it. Right? That's an example of intensifying exploitation of workers. And you can do the same thing with shifting the cost of health care benefits and so forth onto workers, shifting the cost of tax burden, you know, keep cutting the corporate tax, keep cutting investment taxes here, increased depreciation, lower interest rates chronically and constantly reduces the cost of constant capital for businesses, for capitalists, right? Give capitalists more direct subsidies, depress SNL, as we said, by shifting the cost of benefits, insurances on workers, right? Increase exploitation by allowing prices to rise over time and not adjusting the minimum wage, 12 years now, right? That's another way of intensifying exploitation. Overpopulation. Population growth will create, according to Marx, a greater total hours of unemployment, or what he called the Industrial Reserve Army, the unemployed. And that will increase the global labor supply, and that, you know, excess supply drives down price, drives down wages. And of course, we've seen that when you move, when you create the labor market by globalizing it, by moving offshore for cheaper wages and so forth, you know, you're increasing labor supply. A good example is the auto industry, and that tends to compress wages due to excess supply of labor now globally. Example, the auto industry or steel industry. And that's another way of offsetting the tendency of the organic composition of capital to reduce the value of labor in production and therefore compress surplus value. Offset it through other ways. Foreign trade or free trade, Marx talked about, is another way of doing, of lowering the cost of constant capital and even driving down socially necessary labor. So Marx talks about a lot of these examples, right, of what capitalists can and do. By no means is this of you know, exhaustive list here, to countervail the tendency of the organic composition of capital, cost of capital, variable capital, to rise, which, all things equal, leads to the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. It's a tendency. It's not guaranteed. It can be offset, but there it is. The rate, you know, tendency of the falling rate of profit, right? In other words, within capitalism, as it moves to more machinery and more constant capital, it needs less and less labor, but labor is the source of all value. So the profits tend to fall. If we're just talking about value now, remember, we're talking about the core of profits, value-determined profits. We're not talking about market price-determined profits here in Volume 1. Okay. So, in short, the falling rate of profit tendency, right, is an argument that the proportion of constant capital, organic composition capital, rises faster than capitalists can otherwise increase the rate of surplus value. As we have two concepts here. We have organic composition of capital, which is a ratio, by the way, of constant capital to variable capital, right? And we have the rate of surplus value, which is also a ratio. We have two ratios, and we're saying that the falling rate of profit tendency occurs when the first ratio, organic composition of capital, rises faster than the rate of surplus value itself. And as we said, the capitalist can deal with this tendency of the rate of profit to fall by turning to increasing, by other means, the rate of surplus value. Now, the problem is contemporary Marxists, many of them, you know, Mosley and Kleeman, these are contemporary Marxists, Brenner and others, all have argued that it's the rate of surplus value that has been declining over time. Michael Roberts, another one, right? declining over time, and that you can show that this rate is declining right before and during business cycle contractions. You can show. Well, that's a correlation, you see, and it depends upon how you define profits as well. Now, keep in mind, Marx never argued, even in his notes, that this was an explanation of business cycles. But contemporary Marxists do. They argue that this is, they can show, you know, in right 2008-9, you know, the rate went down, the profits went down, and that precipitated the crisis. It had nothing really to do with the fact that the banks went belly up. You know, it was a rate of profit, you know, in the auto companies and the steel companies and so forth that was really behind all this, which is, you know, observationally nonsense. Okay, so again, Marx sees it a long-run breakdown possible explanation, but he never publishes it, right? Contemporary Marxists see this as the explanation of business cycles, right? Well, they use profits from government accounts, government data, government accounts. They look at corporate profits, you know, for Fortune 500 and whatever. And they say, oh, okay, you know, that definition here in the U.S. of corporate profits, we're going to use to explain the market phenomenon with prices of the collapse short term of capitalism. Well, I shouldn't say collapse, but severe contraction of capitalism in the short run, depressions and recessions. We're going to use that market concept. Well, you can't use the falling rate of profit idea using market profits and market prices, because that's not how it was developed. It's developed in Marx based upon value explanations only. Rate of surplus value, organic composition of capital, value concepts, not market concepts, but the definitions of profits they use includes market profits. And by the way, not only profits from producing things, but market profits including financial speculation. You know, multinational corporations, a third of all their profits are from portfolio financial market speculations. So you got financial analysis or financial conditions in here explaining profits using a concept that's only based upon how core profits using value is extracted. They jump. Contemporary Marxists jump and use a concept from capitalist accounts, government accounts, right? GDP, national income accounts, whatever, that includes market-based, price-based, and financial speculative price-based elements of profits to explain, you know, what Marx only intended value, core profits to explain. Okay. What are profits? Well, you know, there's all kinds of definitions of profits. Here's a further problem, right? And if you're talking about capitalist profits and crises, you know, these business cycles and crises are global now. You've got to incorporate profits using capitalist accounts globally, from corporations globally, and not in the U.S., but in other countries. And here you run into a further problem, right? Different countries define profits differently, right? Data collection problems are very great, say in Indonesia and so forth, right? A lot of fraud, a lot of underreporting of profits to avoid taxation everywhere. They're only using reported profits, right? And then what about how capitalists simply use slush funds and put some of their revenue in different funds and don't report it as profits? There's a lot of that game playing going on too. You know, what about profits of multinational corporations that get lowered because of their ability to manipulate intra-company pricing? They manipulate that to reduce their profits. What about in China, state-owned enterprises there, where prices are held very low purposely? Instead of taxing them, they just keep the prices low. And that, of course, underestimates the profits of the state-owned enterprises there. Right. What about profits before or after stock buybacks and dividend payouts, you know, which is over $1 trillion a year? What about if we're talking about profits in multinational corporations for financial asset investing? What happens when you have losses on that portfolio investments, right? So the definition of profits, if they're using capitalist data, you got to aggregate this somehow globally, and you can't. You simply can't. Not only is capitalist data on profits can't be used because, you know, as I said, Marx is talking about value-created profits, not supplemental market-created profits. You're using oranges to predict apples, in other words, as they do, contemporary Marxists. You know, you got a problem of defining and gathering accurately profits itself globally. You can't use it, right? And then they're talking about the rate, not the level of profits, the rate of profits. Well, what do we mean by rate? Well, from one period to next. Well, which period to next? Year to year? What's the base period? You know, they usually don't talk about that. Or they talk about it from just year to year, right? And what do we mean by tendency? A tendency is what? What's the time period that you're going to define tendency in? So there's definitional problems as well as data collection problems that make it impossible, I believe, to talk about the falling rate of profits, even define it, even to estimate it quantitatively. Do profits determine investment? Here's another problem. In other words, investment in real goods is capital accumulation, right? In real business goods, investment is the same as capital accumulation, right? Well, you're looking at, contemporary Marxists look at, the rate of profits, and they don't look at capital accumulation. What is the level of accumulation? Which is very hard because there's so much games playing with depreciation and amortization going on in capitalist accounting. But they seem to say, okay, profit rate, as we've described it from 1 year to the next, 2007 and 8, is associated with the collapse of the Great Recession. Associated, in other words, a correlation, therefore it must be a causation of it. You know, and Marx also talked about secondary exploitation. What is that? Well, secondary exploitation, primary exploitation, of course, is rate of surplus value in production. But once the commodity gets sold in the marketplace, right, we're in the exchange, the world of exchange, well, then what we've got there is capitalists taking back some of the wages that they paid. In other words, the wages equal to SNL on average, right, are paid to workers. But then the capitalists take back some of it. In other words, they exploit labor on top of the initial exploitation in production. Well, how does this work? Well, charging interest for buying goods on credit is a way of taking back some of the wages you pay in the present in the future, you know, over the term that you're paying interest on whatever you bought. And of course, credit and interest is a big factor here. And very clearly, you know, there's a lot of secondary exploitation going on using credit and debt and interest payments, taking back from workers what the wage was you paid them before. Monopoly prices are another way of reclaiming wages that were paid, right? Shifting of the tax burden on the workers, That's another way of exploiting them on top of exploitation. Privatizing social insurances and benefits. In other words, there's a lot of ways that capitalists now in the 21st century have figured out how they can take back some of the wage from the workers they originally paid them. So exploitation is not just an absolute and relative terms in production. Exploitation occurs in the market as well. But contemporary Marxists do not go there. Even though Marx talks about secondary exploitation, they leave that on the ground and they don't really explore the new forms of exploitation that are going on. Exploitation occurs not just in terms of value concepts, right? But exploitation can clearly be shown here just in simple wage terms. You know, since the rise of neoliberalism, since 1982, real wages have not risen for over 100 million workers, have not risen, real wages adjusted for inflation. At the same time, we know profits, right, and capital accumulation, wealth, income, inequality has just skyrocketed, right? We know that. Well, that's obvious. That's exploitation. You know, you don't have to use the labor theory of value to show that exploitation is intensifying, that the capitalists are figuring out ways to pay workers less and keep more and more for themselves, and getting very, very clever at using the state and government to engage in secondary exploitation, right? Okay, but nonetheless, contemporary economists, argue that the falling rate of profit explains short-term business cycle contractions, right? And I have a problem with that for all these reasons I've explained. Now, another issue here, we haven't left ourselves very much time, is the critique of Marx from the right, arguing that Marx never explains, in Volume 1 in particular, how value gets transformed into prices. And that was the transformation problem. Well, Marx started out abstractly talking about value as the core of price, you see. And profits from exploiting value as the core of total profits. He was going to get to the rest in his subsequent volumes, but he never did. So it leaves him open for this criticism that he never really explained how you transform values into price. Well, he did to some extent in his notes in Volume 3 and then in Theories of Surplus Value, another production of notes. He did attempt and began that process, but he never completed it, you see. Never completed it. And the problem is you got inputs, constant capital, variable capital, expressed in value terms, in the organic composition capital concept, right? But you have outputs, in other words, commodities selling in price terms in the marketplace, right? So how do you explain these inputs in value terms also in price terms so that you could have a price-to-price comparison? Price and inputs, price and outputs, commodities, outputs, right? Price-to-price, not just value to price, right? Well, Marx started expressing this, but never really finished the transformation problem clarification, right? It's not that he was, ipso facto wrong. It was he never really got there. Mm-hmm. But if you assume labor is the source of all value and value created in production, both absolute and relatively, is the core of surplus value, is the core of profits, and that market profits fluctuate due to price around that core, which has always been an assumption of classical economics, then you logically, conceptually, don't have a problem of transformation. And the same goes for wage, which is a market concept where it fluctuates around the core of SNL, value that workers are given, allowed to have in production. Wages and profits are market concepts. Within them are the core of value. This is a very classical economics assumption. And part of the assumption, a problem with Marx and the transformation problem, is he's made these classical economic assumptions about, you know, mobility of capital and labor, and same ratios of capital and labor, you know, across industries and so forth, and profitability the same as his beginning start point, and he never really lifts them. This is why Marx attempts a radical transformation of classical economics, but only succeeds partially. And we see in all great economists, this is the case. We saw this with Keynes, right? New conceptual ideas and frameworks and relationships of variables and so forth, you know, transforms much of neoclassical economics, but not completely, doesn't totally succeed, which opens them up to criticism for those who want to go back to previous forms of analysis. Well, that's the same going on here with Marx, right? He succeeds partially to the extent he doesn't succeed. Contemporary mainstreamers say, oh, let's go back to Adam Smith. But we're going to find out when we start talking about Adam Smith in the next couple of weeks that Adam Smith believed the labor is a source of all value, too. He believed that as well. And he's only concerned, however, with how that leads to profits, and assumes, erroneously as well, that all the profits are going to be plowed back into investment. You know, it's not profits that are the key, it's investment, it's capital accumulation that is the key to classical and Marxist analysis. You know, how do we explain how capital expands? Capital grows, you know, regardless of whether you have these short-term aberrations here called depressions and recessions. How does it grow? What is it within capitalism that allows and makes and requires it to continually expand? Well, that's what Smith was looking at, and that's what Marx was looking at too, except Marx says, well, you know, it doesn't always expand. At some point, it's going to break down. But Marx wasn't explaining business cycles, even depressions. Those are short-run phenomena, and the assumptions he's got prevents him, and the conceptual framework he's got prevents him from really explaining short-run analysis. To that, he would have to get to price. And he was moving in that direction, but he never got there. He never wrote about a price explanation of short-term crises. So, to sum up, you know, contemporary Marxist economists are totally missing the point of Marxism when they fixate on this whole idea of the falling rate of profit tendency, using market concepts to explain what was originally a value concept analysis here in Marx. You can't do it. And then there's other problems, you know, we have the data and definitions and so forth, but yet they do that. They're going off in the wrong direction, totally, with this falling rate of profit tendency. They should be looking at how does capitalism expand? In other words, why does capitalism keep accumulating more and more forms of capital? And why is that eventually going to lead to some kind of a crisis? Not just recessions, but a fundamental crisis. That's what they should be trying to explain, but they don't. And of course, those who critique Marx from the right here on the transformation problem are, you know, kind of arguing that he never got to what he said he was going to get. Well, okay, you know, someone else will have to do that. Okay, that's it for our three classes or three shows on Marx's economics versus Marxists today.